I'm Rip Esselstyn, and you're listening to the Plan Strong podcast. Imagine, if you will, a life where you are trapped, imprisoned in a cycle of addiction to alcohol, fentanyl, and food. Now, imagine escaping that prison for a life that is far, far better than you can ever, ever imagine. This is the story of today's guest, Tim Kaufman. I'm going to bring you his harrowing story right after this message from Plan Strong. Hopefully you know by now that we are on a mission, a major mission at Plan Strong, to make it easy, delicious, and convenient to eat more plants. One of the most powerful tools in our toolbox is the Plan Strong Meal Planner. Members of the Meal Planner get access to hundreds of delicious, community-tested, whole food plant-based recipes that are all oil-free and made without refined sugar or excessive sodium. The Meal Planner lets you create and save personal menus, and you can reduce waste with our search by ingredient feature to help you find ways to use up what you have on hand. We also have interactive grocery lists that make it super easy to shop, along with cooking videos to help you gain new skills and confidence in the kitchen. You can even have your meal planned groceries delivered by Instacart right to your doorstep. Members get exclusive discounts at Plan Strong Foods and with other partner brands like Vitamix. Simply visit liveplanstrong.com and then click on the meal planner. Save $20 off the annual membership with the code PSSUMMER20. That's PSSUMMER20. Get Plan Strong. At the pediatric age of 38, Tim Kaufman's doctor essentially left him for dead. His weight, blood pressure, cholesterol, and triglycerides were through the roof, and his self-esteem and self-worth, well, they were practically 6 feet under. He was ready to give up on himself. That is, until one day, he started making the smallest of changes. For Tim, it was getting out of his chair 2 times. That was it. One small change at a time. This eventually led to a little research, and he found forks over knives, the engine to kitchen rescue, fat, sick, and nearly dead, documentaries that he credits with changing his life and his diet to a whole food, plant-based way of eating. Today, Tim is an accomplished athlete training for an Ironman triathlon, and he just released his memoir, Escape, Breaking Free from a Self-Made Prison. Here to share his story is my Plan Strong brother, Tim Kaufman. Tim Kaufman, welcome to the Plan Strong podcast, my man.
Rip, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And thank you for all you do to make the world a healthier and happier place.
Tim, right back at you. So I was part of the summit that you threw a couple months ago. And it was during that summit you told me that you had a book that you were launching. And you had spent several years on it. And it had finally come to fruition. And I want you all to know that here it is. It's called Escape, Tim Kaufman, Breaking Free from a Self-Made Prison. I want everybody that's listening to know that I read this book from cover to cover over the last 2 days. And what you have done here, Tim, is absolutely nothing short of remarkable. And I say that because you don't hold back and you bear it all. The good and the downright incredibly ugly. You spare no expense just exposing this raw and fragile Tim Kaufman from beginning to end. And it is such an incredible journey that you have been on, Tim. So with that being said, are you cool if we kind of talk about your journey here today?
Yeah, I mean, I'm open to anything, but Yeah, I appreciate all your kind words about the book. And, you know, when I started writing the book, the book took about 6 years because I kept starting and stopping. It's very hard, some of the stuff to kind of drudge back up when you think it's behind you. But I made myself a deal. I kept going back and like, no, that's too, I mean, I still have a job. I'm still teaching and stuff for another couple of years. It's like, I don't want people to know about this. I don't want people. And then I said, I either have to write the book like totally open and honest or not. And so I went with write it open and honest. And that's what I did.
Well, you did. And what I was also really impressed with is your writing style and how well everything flowed. And it was so easy to read. And I did not want to put it down until I got to the end. Have you been journaling for a while, or where do you feel you got your writing chops from?
So I am not a writer. I still don't think I'm a writer, but honestly, like that's kind of like part of my story. Like, I don't know what, so I was more of like a Harley, big dude in Carhartts and Harleys and people that, you know, even read books or wrote, you know, those were weird people in my book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at some point in my transformation, I picked up a book, a spiral notebook, and I started just jotting stuff down, whether it was logging my food or the exercise that I had planned. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of did a recap for the day, like kind of a little, you know, how'd you do, one sentence. And that's kind of where I guess my writing started. No, I don't, like, honestly, so I teach now. I teach engineering and technology. But the truth is, like, I dropped out of high school 7 degrees later, two which are postgraduate degrees. I never really took English. I took technical writing, which is just the facts. So I don't really have a writing background.
Well, but you did start journaling, and one of the places that I want to go to today is your first entry that you made into that journal, but I don't want to do it yet. I think a good place to start, and especially since we have a limited amount of time here today, is why don't we start at your dad's funeral? So your dad has just died, you're at his funeral, and you're over 400 pounds. Can you kind of like walk us through where you're... if you can recall where your mindset was that day?
Oh, that day, my mindset was in a terrible place. I almost don't like saying rock bottom because I had many rock bottoms. But if I guess you could say that was probably, you know, that's where I really hit hard. I had tried to clean up a little bit with the opioids. I had stopped and started and stopped. I was actually stringing together quite a few days of not taking them, actually probably for quite a few months at that point. And then, you know, when we got the news that dad had passed away, the first thing I did was go find more pills. Mm-hmm. So I was purposely not in a good place. You know, the book is called Escape. So I had escaped reality, and that's just how I dealt with anything. I didn't want to feel ups. I didn't want to feel downs. I just wanted to feel numb. And I was definitely numb, really bad. Like, I had the spins, everything kind of had an echo, and it was almost like I watched the funeral, through a tunnel. Mm-hmm. So I was in a really bad place. And I, one of the weird things that I remember so vividly about that day is they had these wooden chairs that the funeral director had set up, and they were on uneven ground. You know, we're out in the country here. And I remember sitting on those wooden chairs thinking, I am going to bust right through one of these, and I'm going to make a scene, and I just don't want to deal with it. And I remember, like, trying to hold my body up so I wouldn't put all my weight on the chair. And I was hurting. Like, my legs were trembling because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was trying to take the weight off of them.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and you say in the beginning, you say, this is my story. This is my song. And when I read that in the beginning, I didn't quite get it. But once I got to the end, I did get it. And I think another thing I'd like to talk about right now, before we get too deep into your addictions, the food and the alcohol and the narcotics, is your wife, Heather. and how she has been such an absolute, you refer to her throughout the whole book as your angel, right? And I think it's so absolutely adorable the way you first asked her out on a date. Can you recall that for us?
Yeah, I can't tell you how many people read the book and that know me well, like family that never heard that story. So, yeah, so we went to like private school, and then in eighth grade, we switched over to public. So I was kind of an outsider to begin with. I was not a very popular kid. Heather was a lot more popular than I, and she was a year older than me. And so I was really trying to, what we called back then, is go out with her. I don't even know what that really meant, but, you know, have a relationship. And I had been hounding her, bugging her, and she was getting annoyed. And I picked up the phone. This is still when the phone had a big cord attached to it. Yeah. And I dialed her up. She was babysitting. And I got her on the phone, and I had played, the song was coming on, Say You Will. And I put the phone over the thing, and the whole song went through. I picked it up, thought she'd be gone, but she goes, all right, fine. I'll see you tomorrow at my locker. And that was how we started dating over 35 years ago, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what she put up with is just absolutely, it's remarkable to me. And it just, I guess it, the fact that she never gave up on you, and she, as you talk about in the book, she somehow knew that there was that spark, that there was that ember that was still in there that just needed to basically, you needed to rake the coals and have it kind of breathe some life into it.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like a lot of this, I mean, we were always like best friends, like ever since high school. So it's not how it started out. You know, we had big dreams and big hopes and the white picket fence. I can't tell you how many times we'd come home from a date just dreaming about the day we'd have our own home to come to instead of, you know, mom and dad. So we got married really young. I had been 19 for, I think, 3 weeks. So we got married really young, and we had the whole world in front of us, you know. And I think just little by little, those dreams just got chipped away throughout my journey. And I'm just being real. Like, there was no less than 100 times she had every right to walk away, mm-hmm. and she didn't.
Hmm. And, and why do you think she didn't?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, obviously we were super committed to each other. Maybe she saw something that I didn't. I had given up. You know, I had gotten to the point when I was 30, and I had just, like, I was just done. Like, I was just waiting to check out. I knew it was soon. I just, you know, I was just kind of, I wasn't even surviving, you know. I was just trying to get numb day after day after day.
Well, and tell me, because I wasn't quite sure on the timeline of some of this stuff. Because you started working in, well, you were able to get work on that farm. That really wonderful gentleman that gave you the job on the farm. And then you worked in the machine plant, right? That your dad worked in, correct?
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's where I started having physical problems. Going from the farm, I kept like falling and twisting my ankles and things like that. But we just kind of chalked that up to, I was a klutz. When I went into the factory, it was a very big equipment. And I was a tool and die maker / machinist. And so, and I was working over my head a lot, and that's when my shoulder started dislocating. And, you know, it had gotten to the point that just the pressure from me sneezing would actually dislocate the shoulder. So, you know, we weren't really big into doctors. You know, my mother was a stubborn German, and, you know, we don't do doctors. We don't need medicine. We're too tough for that. So I toughed it out until I totally couldn't. It was just like hanging out of me. Went to the doctor. He took some x-rays, and my capsule in my shoulder was actually 7 times larger than it should have been. Everything was so stretched out. So he thought it was just a quick fix. Like, we could cut my back open and pull all the tendons and, you know, kind of fold everything together, draw everything back in, and he'd stitch me up and I'd be fine. But once he got in there, that's when I was diagnosed with this Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which basically the collagen in my body has a genetic screw up, which causes like the glue that holds my body together. It's like bubblegum. So I like scarring, you know, we noticed like I'd get a scar and it would like fish mouth, like all this pink scar tissue. Mm-hmm. My sister also has it. And basically the prognosis, like right in my early 20s, was go home, do as little as you possibly can. They had disability papers for me, which I tossed in the garbage. They said that I'd be in a wheelchair within 5 years. And this is how we started our marriage, you know, with a brand new job, but we just bought a rental property and a new home. And we were ready to take on the world. Like we were both hardworking people. And now they're telling me that I'm not going to be able to work. And not only that, I'm going to be in a wheelchair. Along with that came the narcotics, because now we have to manage this chronic pain. And that's when I started. And this is, you know, back in the early 90s and mid 90s, you know, I went the regular route that, you know, I took the Lortabs till they didn't work, then the Percocets, then Oxys, like they were getting dispensed like candy. So once I got on the Oxycontin, that was really pulled me in hard. And then, you know, I'm kind of going over about a decade of pills and stuff, but I would go through the same kind of things. Like they would work till they didn't work, and then they'd get more, then I'd get creative to find more. And then my doctor said, I want to try this drug that's a transdermal patch so you don't have the ups and downs. And that drug was fentanyl. And I had never heard of it. I mean, it wasn't a thing. And, you know, we know now that fentanyl is awful. It's killing just hundreds of thousands of kids and adults. But this fentanyl patch was a transdermal patch, which means I had a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week supply of it. Along with this, they said, well, keep taking the tablets because these are your brain. When I say tablets, I'm saying like my pills used to come in like Pringles can size. Like, you know, I would get 240 tablets in a prescription. You know, it wasn't like 30, 60 or 90. These were huge bottles.
And how long would a Pringle size jar of pills last you?
Not long. I mean, it, you know, before I knew it, I was sometimes taking, you know, over 30, 40 tablets in a day or more, because they just didn't have the same effect. Like if someone would have taken what I was taking, you know, without having a tolerance, they would have been dead 10 times over.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, and I know this sounds weird. Well, you know, then, so after the fentanyl worked great. Like it was super, super effective. But it was the same exact cycle. It worked great until it didn't. And we did that too. You know, we did the fentanyl. We kept going up the dosage until I hit the max. So, you know, here I am on the max dose of fentanyl, hundreds of pills in a month. By this time, from not moving and finding my other greatest escape was food, right? I was eating. It was easy to get. It was just like a drug. And, you know, the alcohol came in after I couldn't sleep. You know, after I was taking the max dose of fentanyl, all these pills, and I couldn't sleep through the night. And so I didn't know what to do. You know, I grew up in a super conservative Christian household. I never saw my parents drink. I never saw them smoke. I never hear them swear unless I did something really stupid. And I hadn't been around drinking because we got married so young. We kind of missed that whole party scene. But for some reason, about 4 or 5 nights of no sleep, I stopped at a liquor store on my way home. And, you know, that night I filled up an entire tumbler. It was a Disney tumbler glass full of vodka. And I took a handful of pills and I drank the whole glass. And I wish I could say I woke up the next day and had puked all over, had alcohol poisoning, and I felt like crap for 2 days. I wish I could say I learned my lesson, but unfortunately, that would be just my normal routine. You know, there was no buildup for the alcohol. It was like full on.
Let me backtrack for a sec, Tim. So the fentanyl, how long were you on the fentanyl before that kind of, you reached the max dosage of that and it wasn't really doing what you wanted to do anymore?
Is that So I would say years. I'm sure, you know, it's such, that was such a slow cycle because it, I mean, first of all, I remember putting that patch on, like, how it looked like a giant Band-Aid. It's like, how could this do anything to you? Like, I totally didn't respect it because of that. It just looked so innocent. Like, the pills I could see. But I remember the first time I took that, I just sat in a chair and I was like, whoa, you know, for hours. And what happened is through the months, the patch was a 36-hour patch. So it would kind of dwindle. And then through the months, you'd start, like, about day 2.5, you'd start getting, like, antsy. Like, I used to say my veins would itch, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, a month later, at 2 days, you're like, oh, man. And then you start putting extra patches on. And then, again, getting creative with that stuff, too, which I don't want to give anyone ideas. But,
yeah.
So it did, you know, through the months, it was like a gradual thing. And then you'd go to the next level and then kind of fix everything for a couple months, you know, and I'm going to say within a year, it was useless, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't useless. It was useless to take away pain. But it wasn't useless to not make me sick. Addiction is weird. You start to get that high or that buzz or that escape. And then, you know, in time you start taking it, you know, just so you don't get withdrawals, right? Like, just because I'm starting to get antsy, I'm starting to get withdrawals, so I take more. And then the last stage, and it's an awful stage, you just use or drink just so you don't feel as sick. Because you can't fill the void. It's an unfillable void after a while.
Yeah. You talk in vivid detail how you just had such a string of just awful nights of sleep. You just couldn't figure it out. And that's why I think you initially decided to go to the alcohol store, which you said you parked in the parking lot and you just, like, deliberated going in because you didn't want anybody to see you. You'd never been in a liquor store before.
Never. No.
My question to you is, you went in that first time, you got the vodka, and then you started, you know, the alcoholism. How often would you go back to that same store to get alcohol? And what did the owner think after a while? He must have thought, wow, this guy's really full-blown, like, into it.
Yeah, so, you know, people oftentimes think that addicts or drunks, you know, are these lazy people that just want to be in that position. But the reality is, once you get so far in, you have to run it like a business. I mean, we have a couple businesses now, and it literally takes the same kind of skills and systems in place and inventory. So, you know, I'm a numbers guy. So I know that probability says the less times I go to that store, the less chance I have to get caught. So it only makes sense when I go to get six, you know, of the biggest bottles they have, which is 1.75 liters. So that's what I started doing. The first time I went in there, like, I didn't even know what I was going to get. I just knew I didn't know anything about alcohol. So the guy's like, can I help you with something? I'm like,
yeah,
vodka. I need vodka. Cause I knew that was the big one. And so, you know, he pointed to where it was. I went all the way down to the bottom, got the cheapest stuff I could find. And yeah, I probably went back like 2 days later to the same guy, but then I would mix it up. And this is, like, I would go to different stores, have different routines. But this is, you know, one of the things that you're talking about with Heather. You know, I started manipulating her to the point where I would coax her into either driving to make it super easy, because we could drive around back of the store where the, you know, deliveries were made, and I'd have her sit, like, off the lights. So she was right there to swoop me back up. And I kind of roped her right into helping me get pills and alcohol. And
so was she well aware of the extent of your pill addiction and your alcohol addiction?
She was aware it was bad, but I don't know if she ever knew just how bad it was. I let her see enough that she knew what I was doing. But I got really good at just showing pieces. And honestly, Rip, it's the same for food. And it's embarrassing to talk about, but even going to pick up, you know, fast food for dinner, you know, I would always order extra food and I would eat it before I got into the house, hide the wrappers. And it was that same kind of thing. Like, she knew I was eating a lot of food, but she had no clue how much food I was sneaking you know, I was eating dinner before dinner. And so it was the same with the alcohol. She knew that there was some bottles coming in, but, you know, I opened that one chapter up with, I went to empty the bottles out of my closet. Well, she wasn't home and I had a contractor bag, literally could not pull that bag through the doorway of my closet. And that, no pun intended, but that was a very sobering experience for me.
Yeah. And you, and the title of that chapter was Skeletons in the Closet, very appropriately. So at this point, you look in the mirror and what do you see back, Tim?
A person I hated. It was hard to even make eye contact. I would avoid the mirror. I mean, I would stand in front of it, you know, to shave and brush my teeth, but like, I did not want to look. I didn't want to make eye contact. And I think, you know, going back to the addiction thing, you know, there's no doubt that, and maybe you could even say, I don't even like to say this, but maybe you could say I was even justified. I was taking pills for literally, you know, a dislocation, like my whole body dislocates. And so it's painful. I'm, you know, by the time I was 20, I was loaded with arthritis and I was in pain. So these drugs, the alcohol, the food, they were, I was escaping physical pain, no doubt about it. But early on, at some point, I was not masking physical pain anymore. I was masking emotional and spiritual pain way more than physical. I had went way beyond masking physical pain. And so when you can't look at yourself in the mirror, you know, it's this cycle. It's you look at yourself, you hate who you see, you know, this is not the purpose for your life. You don't really know what the purpose is, but this can't be it. You feel worse for yourself. So you go take more pills or more food or more booze to try to just cover that all up. Because the worst thing you can do is have a real conversation with yourself. You know,
did people in your life, it not pull you aside and say, hey, Tim, I think you've got some issues that need to be, you need to deal with. Did that happen or not? Or did it just kind of go over your head?
Well, I think that, because people ask this too about Heather, and my kids were pretty well hidden. They were young at the time. They're in their 30s now, but at the time they were very hidden. And I think that I had this perfect, the same way I was justifying my behavior, everyone that knew me could justify it too. I mean, I had this weird disease. They were doing studies on me. They were shipping me to, you know, UB Med to dislocate me and take pictures. You know, I was like a circus freak. And so it always was, Tim is sick. How is Tim doing? How, like, there was always, I was always at the emergency room. I was at the doctor at least once every 2 weeks. Like, that was a good month. It had gotten so bad. Every Tuesday, I would go get my knees drained. Like every single Tuesday, I knew that's what I was doing. I was getting, you know, these big old syringes sucked out of my knees. Like, I really, you know, have a problem. I have a disease. And I think that my behavior was almost justified. So no one, I mean, would you ever go up to a, you know, a sick person and say, hey, you need to get your crap together? Like, they should have. I wouldn't have listened, but I hid behind this excuse, really.
Well, and I would imagine, so when you were having the knees drained quite frequently and all that, you were probably at 400 pounds, correct?
I was getting there, yeah. So when I was about 38, that was a terrible day. Standing on the scale and watching the nurse, and I swear they would start lift like 150, like looking at me, they just keep moving that big weight up, sliding the small weight over. And I just wanted to rip that weight and go right to the top. But, I remember it went to 350 and she's sliding it. And I'm like, come on, you got to tip soon. And it just got to the end and didn't move. And my heart just dropped. And I saw her, you know, put an X where the weight should be. And I'm thinking to myself, well, now he's not going to know how much weight I gained. Like, this, you can't track it anymore. So I guess I'm free to do whatever I want. But that was an awful feeling.
So you have a whole chapter in your book where you take people through a typical day in the life of Tim at 400 pounds with, when you're fully addicted to the pills and the booze. Can you kind of, and the food, and the food. Can you kind of walk us through what a from breakfast or waking up until going to bed looks like?
Yeah, that's tough. I never had anyone ask me that. That's a tough one. That chapter, I think that you talk about the chapter I don't want to write. I literally didn't want to write that. And it took me forever.
I can see why. And if you don't want to go through it, that's fine. But I'm just
I'll tell you what, Rip, I'll make you a deal. You let me tell that day in the life and let me talk about a day in the life now.
Oh no. We're going there.
We'll even that out. So again, you know, for folks listening, this sounds so drastic, but the reality is, you know, no one is safe from what I'm about to talk about, because it wasn't this like switch that goes on and all of a sudden, you know, you give up on life and you just want out. This was a very slow fade over time. And I never saw it coming until I was so far in that I didn't know how to get out. But so I typically would wake up in the morning very, very sick, very spin. I don't think I've ever said this on a podcast before. I got in the habit of taking our biggest bath towel. I'd fold it in about four times and I put it down before I went to bed because I knew that I would lose bladder function through the night. So I would usually urinate every night. Most of the time I'd wake up with some vomit on the side of my face and spins. I just felt awful. I would make my way to the shower, try to get some hot water going on me. And, you know, the taste in my mouth is probably the worst thing, and the dry mouth. And as soon as I got out of the shower, the first thing I could think of is like, I'm already going through withdrawals just from sleeping through the night. I'm already withdrawing. And if anyone's ever been through withdrawals, I would not wish that on my worst enemy. They're awful, especially fentanyl withdrawals are just, you'd rather be dead than go through them. And I would go to my dresser, you know, and I'd pop a handful of pills just to try to get going. Most of the time I would chew them up so they worked faster. And I would make my way down, you know, to get to work. And by this time that I'm talking to, Heather would have to put my socks and shoes. I couldn't get dressed. Just putting my clothes on was a chore. I'd be out of breath and already sweated up. The one thing I didn't put in the book, but Heather had went out and bought me duplicates of my shirts because by the time I'd get to work, I'd be so sweated wet that I was embarrassed to change my shirt at work. So she would buy me duplicates so I could take two clean shirts to work, sweat one up, put the next one on, and no one knew that I was changing. On the way to work, I would stop at Burger King. I always got two sausage, egg, and croissants with two orders of hash browns and always a large diet something, whether it's Coke or Pepsi, to wash it down. I'd get to work and I just would be so tired that every one of our planning mods I teach, I would just kind of take a nap on my desk with my head slumped over. I would do what I could do to, you know, do my job. Lunchtime, I would go get 2 half-pound burritos from this local taco place. Most of the time, Heather would pack me a lunch, so I would eat that as well. After work is done, I would leave and I would get my snack before dinner, and that back to Burger King. I'd usually get about 4 things off the dollar menu. 2 of them were always like a Whopper Jr. Then literally on the way, as I'm sitting in line for fast food, I'd be calling and ordering pizza and wings to eat with the kids on the way home. And then as soon as I got home, it was game on to see how many pills I could drink. I could take. And drinking only really happened towards the very end. This changed a little bit, but I was only drinking literally 5 minutes before I went to bed. But by this time I was drinking, you know, half of that bottle. I had 1.75 liter and I would drink just about half of it. You know, about a 2 cups of it. And so I wasn't really like drinking all night. Towards the end, I would start coming home and drinking earlier. And then I would just pass out and just repeat this process day in and day out.
Did you ever tally up how many calories you were consuming a day on average?
Yeah, I speak to a lot of high schools, and so the kids always want to see. It's very visual, so I'd actually show them what I was eating. And it was over 10,000 calories, give or take. Awesome. So, yeah.
So how do the kids react to your story? What do they ask great questions afterwards? Are they moved? What are you finding?
Yeah. So I don't know. So I show this a lot on social media because I like to remember it, but I have literally thousands of letters from kids, like stacks, like 2 feet high. And it's really cool that, the students there now wouldn't recognize me, 10 years ago, but the kids that were there for my journey, they're almost 30 now. And we're friends on Facebook. They keep in touch. We had a plant-based restaurant. A lot of them would come in and say hello. But the students, I'm so blessed to be able to do this because, the kids in my school, we have a very big high school. Every one of them watches Forks Over Knives in health class. And then when they finish watching that film, I come in and give them a talk on nutrition. And then usually later on in the year, I give them another talk about addiction, recovery, and social media stuff, self-worth, goals, challenges, overcoming challenges, life's ups and downs. So I am so happy that I get, so every kid, thousands of kids go through our school district and I get to talk to each one. And I've done some, commencement talks before at high school. So they're inspired, they're moved. But they always ask like, what do you miss the most? Or they really want to know what I eat in a day most of the time.
Yeah. That is so fantastic that you are talking to the kids about addiction, because we know that it is absolutely so prevalent in this culture. And I think just about every family has seen it in some way, shape, or form. So you say in your book, and then this is going to lead to the next place that I want to go with you. You say there wasn't a drug in the world that was strong enough to hide me from the self-loathing and bitter person that I had become. And you say that now you go to bed with a smile on your face and a song in your heart. That is so absolutely spectacular. And so let's talk for a sec about where was that pivot? And I'm going to lay it out for you based upon the book. So your father died. Your Ma B, which is your wife's mother, who you just adore to the moon and back, and was so selfless and giving and wonderful, she is now on her deathbed, right? And she's on her deathbed. She's got very, very little energy. And she says four words to you, Tim, when you go in to visit her in the hospital that basically flip the switch and change everything. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, that was... I tell people that perspective switch saved my life, but it came with a very high price. And yeah, so Ma B, she kind of wasn't feeling good, kind of had like a cold flu thing, wasn't getting better. I mean, we begged her to go to the doctor. She wouldn't. She was busy working. And so finally she broke down, went to the doctor. She was diagnosed with leukemia. And it seems like overnight, it went from who's going to take the kids to softball to who's staying with Ma tonight. And we have a cancer hospital here that is cutting edge. It's called Roswell Cancer Center. And they do amazing things there, but I had never been there in my life. I mean, we know it because it's a world-renowned place here in the city of Buffalo. But I went up... I call it the Roswell experience because I went into Roswell and I don't know what Heather was doing. And I don't really remember, but I know it was just me and Ma B, and she was so tired. She was waiting on a transfusion and she would get so tired before she got transfused. And she opens her eyes super slow and she says, "How's your knee?" And it just pierced me. It shows you how cool of a lady she is, but I had complained so much. That's all I ever did. My knee hurts, my ankle hurts, my shoulder hurts, everything hurts. I wish I had this. I don't have this. If I just had this, that I just got so consumed in everything that I needed and everything that was wrong that I never stopped to think about the things that were right. And in that day, I thought, oh my gosh, she's worried about my knee. Like, she's waiting for a blood transfusion. Like, are my problems really that big in comparison? And I remember, like, that really hurt. And walking out of Roswell, it even compounded more because it was so sad leaving her. You know, she just loved life. She was just full of life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she felt really bad when we'd walk away. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, you know, my knee sucks, but I'm walking away from the hospital and I get to walk out on my own power. And there's going to be people that instead of complaining about a knee, they're going to get their whole leg amputated from a tumor. And I get to walk out of the hospital doors and there's people behind me that will never come home. And it really changed perspective that, you know what? I got healthy kids. I got a wife that loves me. I got a warm place to sleep. I have no chemo in my veins. I'm not waiting for transfusions. And I don't know. I just started looking for things to be grateful for. And that was a huge change for me. You know, it was because I do all these plant-based things and my transformation, I think, you know, the plant-based was certainly one of my best tools, but I don't think it would have mattered if I wouldn't have found gratitude first. And then after my dad passed away during that time, we found out he had like a lung thing. We thought he had pneumonia. So he went and got a chest x-ray. And they found out that dad had stage 4 kidney cancer that had metastasized to his whole body. And here, my dad is my best friend. Like, we hunted together, we fished together, we built stuff together. We had an amazing relationship. And here the doctor saying he has 6 months to live. Well, my dad didn't make it 6 months. He made it 6 weeks to the day. And I lost my best friend in the whole world.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that was the next switch that kind of flipped was, you know, life is precious, you know, and we say, you know, we pay lip service to this thing like, well, we're not promised tomorrow. But do we really understand that, you know, when you're sitting at the side of a 65-year-old man's funeral whose life was just snuffed out so early? Like, life is precious. Mm-hmm. And here I am wasting days. Not only am I wasting days, I'm complaining about how I'm wasting them instead of enjoying everyone. And then, you know, after that, you know, Heather's mom would lose her battle. She had leukemia that would turn into lymphoma. And ultimately, a brain tumor would take her life. And, you know, here are two most precious people in the world just gone. And it's like, they would do anything to come. They would do anything just to live one more day to spend with their family. And here I am just wasting my life, just trying to escape it and just pass time until I passed away. So, yeah, those are two very important kind of switches, I guess, if you want to call them that.
Yeah. Well, and in the book, you kind of describe it as you talked about how your life gets snuffed out. But yours wasn't quite snuffed out. And between your father and Ma B, they were able to kind of turn over a little bit of an ember that was still flickering, that still had a little life in it. And then you said that God blew on it and ignited your passion and your purpose for living again. And so what was it that you wrote in your diary on August 3rd?
So I think this is a good point.
Yes.
I love sharing my story, but I love teaching more than I love sharing my story. And I think this is a good point for, you know, people that are listening to this. Like, I'm going to tell you, I did a lot of wrong stuff. In fact, in the beginning, I did everything wrong. But looking back, it was the best thing that I could ever do because I did something. And I would like to encourage people to do, if you're stuck, do something, even if you don't have it figured out, even if it's wrong, just do something because it'll get you out of that rut. And so that's what I did. This is really weird. I don't believe in coincidence, but I have no idea why I did this. I asked Heather for a spiral notebook. The kids had burned up a couple pages in it. So I tore them out and I started I mean, so my goal was not to be healthy. My goal was not even to get healthy. My goal was, I'm going to go back just a little bit, but I don't know what made this day special, but I sat down at the kitchen table with my socks and my shoes, and Heather, I didn't even ask Heather. She came right over, slid my sock on, slid the second sock on, and she tapped the side of my leg. Like, not in a condescending way, but she goes, okay, you're all set, kind of like you would a little kid. And I slid my shoes on. And when our eyes met that morning, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm the next funeral. Like, and I don't know why this stuff was in my head, but weird things like the funeral brunch, like, oh my gosh, she's going to have to call a restaurant and get that taken care of. She's going to have to pick out a casket. I wasn't going to make it another year. And I think my doctor knew that. I had gotten to the point where I would lay on my bed and I'll put the remote for the TV. And my heart was pounding so hard that it would get air under it. You could literally see every beat. You could see air underneath the remote. And all I could think of was, we just buried two people. I did not know all the stuff that goes in gets crammed into 2 days of preparing for a funeral, but I did not want Heather to have to do that. I wanted to literally put space between funerals. I had no interest in like getting healthy or any. I just wanted to live a little longer. Uh-huh. I feel like that I was playing the cards that I was dealt. I was doing okay with them, but I had a bad deck of cards and or a bad hand of cards. And what was I going to do about it?
Yeah.
So that's where I grabbed a notebook and I'm like, well, first, you know, I tried to get the bariatric surgery and I was so sick. I was denied for that. I thought that would be my way out. At the time I went to get the I thought was a rubber stamp. My blood pressure was 255 over 115. My heart rate was over 125 laying on the table.
Yeah.
I was on almost 20 prescription meds a month. I mean, anything. I was on two blood pressure pills, a calcium channel blocker, a beta blocker. I was on a statin. I was on all sort of stuff. They'd get rid of one thing and get a side effect for the other. And I was not in good shape. My kidneys had shut down about three times. Probably more than that. And I knew I was in bad shape, but I was in such bad shape, the doctor wouldn't sign off on the surgery. He didn't know how I would react to the anesthesia mm-hmm. with all the drugs I was on, and he was worried about my heart. So he denied the surgery, and I went home. I'm like, he killed me. This is my now it's my doctor's fault. Like, all these bad choices I made, of course, are my doctor's fault. But I remember laying and not to keep going back to that Ma B, but, you know, I remember laying there in bed thinking, what am I going to do? Like, I'm done. And I couldn't stop thinking about the last day she went to Roswell. And, you know, at this point, I don't want to get real graphic about it, but she had a very sizable, noticeable tumor coming out of her head. And I mean, she was just, you know, she was at the end of her life. And the doctor is like, Carol, why do you want to keep getting radiation? And she goes, I just want to be here for my family. And I couldn't shake that. You know, I couldn't shake that out of my head that night. And I'm like, man, just out of respect for Ma B's life, mm-hmm. I got to do something. I don't know what it is, but I got to do something. So that's when I grabbed the notebook and I wrote down the song that I had earlier in the day. It says, this is the first day of the rest of your life. And I wrote down a menu. And I knew that, you know, turkey was better than red meat. I was eating a ton of like cheddar cheese, sharp cheese. I knew that mozzarella was supposed to be more healthy. So I wrote down some of these swaps. And I thought, okay, I got the food down. So that's a start. I got to get exercise. Well, at this point, about a week prior to this, I had gotten out of my chair in my office and I actually broke both handles off. I was lifting myself up. I broke both handles. I was humiliated. And my colleague, you know, he came down and he goes, oh, that chair has seen better days. And he wheeled me in a new chair. And I thought, man, get in the chair. That's what I got to do. If I can sit down in the chair and stand up, then I can do it twice. So my exercise literally was chair times two.
Yeah.
And that was my exercise. And you know what? Looking back, I was doubling my workload. Mm-hmm. Sure, it's not an ultra or an Ironman, but I was doubling my workload, which I don't know if I could do that today. Yeah, and then I got home and the page looked so empty. I'm like, oh, and I also wrote something I was grateful for. And in that time, it was my family. I wrote something I was grateful for that day. And I got home and I looked it over. I'm like, yeah, I did everything on there. And I just put at the bottom, I said, you did good. And I just flipped it. Never thought about it till I was writing my book. But the reality was, you did good in the bottom of that book was the first act of self-love that I could remember in my life. And what's cool about it, writing it down, I couldn't take it back. You know, I couldn't self-loathe and say, yeah, you didn't really do it. You think you did. It was there in black and white. And it was the first time I'd ever celebrated success. And that success would want, you know, it would breed more success because I felt good about that. And that's kind of where my journey, I guess, started.
Yeah. And then that led to you basically stopping the booze, stopping the narcotics and the fentanyl and all that.
Yeah, the pills I was up and down, you know, kind of always withdrawing on them and never could get enough. things like so then, you know, as I'm going through that, I catch this film called Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead on Netflix, which is, you know, that's how my plant-based journey started, was through a 30-day juice fast. But I can remember standing over my juicer with a whole, like, lip full of Copenhagen snuff, sipping kale, cucumber, and green apple juice. And I'm like, something's wrong. Like, I can't be trying to fix myself with nutrition while I'm poisoning myself. But yeah, the pills went first, alcohol, cold turkey. Again, for your listeners, go get help. There's help out there. I was too embarrassed in the public sector. I should have got help. The fentanyl was a little different story than cold turkey, but the fentanyl was very hard to come off of. And, you know, using my engineering background, I got some dial calipers out and I made some scratches on a template. And, you know, every time I'd put a new patch on, I'd cut a 16th of an inch off and discard it. And man, within a few months, the patches got smaller and smaller. And, you know, it got to the point where it wasn't worth putting that last one on. And man, that was freedom right there, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Congrats, Tim, on that. Huge congrats. Again, you know, you say you don't have to have everything figured out to take that first step. What does the date December 31st, 2012 mean to you?
Pickled herring. Yeah. So, that was, so I watched Joe Cross. It was so inspiring, to be honest with you, Rip. I had no clue what this guy was doing. I just knew he got results and he got the same results I wanted to get. And so the truth is, like, I didn't do anything heroic here, because if he would have been putting steak and pizza on that machine, I would have done it.
You said in the book, you said raccoon turds.
Yeah. Yep. It's true. I didn't even really pay attention to what, I mean, I kind of knew what he was doing. That the thing that I was most focused on is, you know, he felt so good. And, you know, I didn't even care so much about the weight loss, but he was getting rid of stuff that he had dealt with forever, medical, chronic illness. And plus, he met a bunch of people along the way. He did a 60-day fast, and it was so inspiring that I ordered a juice faster or a juicer and decided to do a fast on January 1st. And, you know, I went out and got some produce. And so it was just about midnight, and we had a tradition of raw fish. I have no idea why. I don't even know what it's for. But it had toothpicks in it, and I popped one in my mouth, and I still had like 40 seconds. And I'm like, I'll grab another one. So I took a couple pieces of pickled herring.
Yeah.
Never thinking that that would be the last animal product I would ever consume. But January 1st came, and, you know, the first 3 days of the juice fest were hell. It was awful. But I know Joe had trouble too. So when I had to, I would just go to bed. And by day four, my hunger had subsided. You got to remember something, you know, with this disease I have so much inflammation in my joints. But, you know, the fast food, the oils, the salts, the sugars, the animal products, these are all very inflammatory foods. And all of a sudden, those come to a stop, and I'm flooding my body with nutrients. It's going right into my bloodstream. So it's like a double whammy. You know, I'm getting rid of the poison, and I'm giving my body. You know, the cool thing about this, that I think the biggest thing that's that just jumps out at me, is that our bodies don't want to be sick. They don't want to be hurting. They want to be healthy, but we got to give them the fuel to get there. And I wasn't giving my body the right fuel. So day four, hunger subsides. By day five, I get goosebumps every time I tell this. And I've told this story literally 1,000 times.
Make it 1,001.
Day five, I woke up in the morning and I was in the same exact position that I'd fallen asleep. And that was a miracle to me. I had spent so many nights, a decade in pain and just tossing. You know, with EDS, every time you lay down, your joints kind of relax. And that's when you get all the dislocation and the arthritis starts crying. And man, you know, 5 days, and that's all I ever wanted to do was wake up with a full night's sleep. Day seven, eczema starts going away. My eyes start clearing up. Sleep apnea goes. I'm not snoring as loud. You know, through day 15 and 20, I have more energy. I'm bored sitting watching TV. I'm forgetting to take medicines. My skin color's coming back. I'm feeling like $1 million, but I'm like, what am I going to do? I can't juice the rest of my life. Because I watched Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead, a film called Forks Over Knives.
Never heard of it.
And I was going to say, Rip, you're the first person I ever heard say the word nutritional yeast. And I'll never forget you climbing up, you know, that fireman's pole. And what that did is showed me, like, I could just consume, I could eat what I was juicing along with, you know, legumes and grains and whole grains and nuts and seeds. And I had my plant-based diet. I didn't really know the plant-based diet at the time, but yeah, I had everything I needed. And, you know, I think it worked to my advantage about not having a whole bunch of information. Like, that was all I knew. So that was all I did. And I think the start of my journey was very simple and unconfused. And now I feel like we're swimming in information out there. And, you know, there was no vegan Impossible burgers and all this other stuff to get confused by. I just knew that if I ate whole grains, I fell in love with lentils and kale, and I learned how to use an Instant Pot. I wasn't really a good cook, but I knew how to jam stuff in the Instant Pot and it would come out tasting good. If it didn't, I'd make soup out of it. And that's how I started. I kept it really super simple.
Yeah. And so food was able to do the opposite of what it did previously. Now it was able to truly transform your life. And you know, you talk about how you watch Forks Over Knives, and you talk in really great detail about that first apple that you had and how incredible that apple was. But what I want to do is I want to skip over the food part right now. You know, you were able to lose 200 pounds. You were able to get off the 20 prescription meds that you were on. You were able to bring your cholesterol down from 300 to 107 without meds.
I think it's 103 now, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. But what I want to talk to you about right now is the walk and that flutter that you got in your stomach when your wife basically asked you to go on a walk with your kids, and how that really has led to your athletic endeavors.
Yeah. So Heather, you know, she was walking with the kids quite often. The kids were younger, and she was getting ready to leave. And she goes, "Hey, do you want to go for a walk?" And I'm like, "What'd you do to the car? Why would you walk when there's a vehicle in the driveway?" It didn't make sense to me. And so I was kind of I don't know. I wasn't nasty, but I was kind of like so sarcastic. I felt bad because I could just see that look in her eyes. And I'm like, "Hold on, I'm coming." At the time, I was in these things called immobilizers. So the doctors thought it was the best thing to do to brace everything up so it would stop falling apart. My knees were awful. So they put me in immobilizers. And what an immobilizer is, if you ever like really injure your leg acutely, they lock your whole leg. It's almost like you have a log. And they had me in two of these things. So if you can imagine, you know, I was pretty big and I got these two like tree trunks that I'm walking on. And so the goal was to walk about, we didn't know it at the time, but it was to one street turnaround. But, you know, after I clock it, it's 3/4 of a mile out and back. And I didn't make it. I was so excited to be with them and be back a part of the family because I was always left behind. We got to the point we couldn't even get in the car for more than 40 minutes. I'd be vomiting all over the place. My knees couldn't handle it. So it was really nice to be part of the family. And I got a little less than halfway through the walk and I was done. I just couldn't go anymore. And I felt awful. So Heather kind of made a game out of it. Like, hey, let's go rescue daddy. Let's go get the car. So they came back, picked me up, and I put a bunch of ice on my knees. I almost went to the emergency room. But the next weekend, man, I just had a burn to go. I was mad that I didn't finish because I really wanted that. And I went back and I finished that walk. And then the next weekend, you know, we'd walk a little longer. And from there, I did. The doctors told me to never walk on uneven ground. I ended up picking up a pair of really solid hiking boots and I started hiking. And, you know, 1 mile turned into two and then two turned into five. And that's kind of my activity journey started there.
It sure did. And you went from that to, I mean, doing triathlons, doing a half Ironman in Lake Placid, and doing what? Was it 46 peaks? Or what was it?
I did have my eyes on that, but after I climbed my first viewless peak, I decided it wasn't for me. But yeah, I did climb. So the we call them the high peaks. So there's 46 high peaks in the Adirondacks. That's kind of a really funny story. My cousin comes over and he shows me this picture he took with his phone. And he said, you know, he said the typical, oh, you know, the picture doesn't do it justice. You got to see it with your own eyes. And then he said something that was literally life-changing for me. He said, do you realize how few people stand on top of that mountain and see it with their own eyes? And I'm like, I got to be one of those people. So I call my doctor, the same doctor that denied me the bariatric surgery. I said, hey, doc, I'm going to be climbing mountains soon, so I got to get out of these immobilizers. What are we going to do about it? And Rip, he didn't laugh at me. He said, I'm going to send you to a prosthetic place. They casted my legs. They made me these really fancy carbon fiber braces. And I just started walking stairs, 5-10 stairs, turned into 20, turned into 30, to eventually hundreds of stairs to where I would actually just time myself. And that led to in 2012, I climbed my first high peak and it was magical. You know, I'm supposed to be in a wheelchair and I'm standing 4,700 feet climb on top of the world, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk to you for a second about grace, the grace race and conquering the hill. And because to me in reading all about everything that you've done, all the ultras and the triathlons and the 5Ks and everything, it sounds like that 5K was, maybe it isn't, but from my perspective, from reading the book, it seems like that was the most heartfelt accomplishment that you had with your wife, Heather.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. That was the most special finish. I think what made it extra special is we didn't know what we were doing. You know, I didn't even know what a bib was. I'm like, what is this piece of paper? I watch everyone like sticking pins in themselves. I'm like, what are you guys doing? So we really didn't know what we were getting into. And in fact, I'll tell you what, when I asked Heather if she'd want to do a 5K, she had no idea how long a 5K was. And my daughter chimes in and she goes, do you realize that's for real people? And I'm like, well, we're real people. She goes, no, like real runners. And I'm like, well, we could do it. So it's funny because I live on a 1/3 of a mile loop, right? And I went around and I put about 5 water bottles out. So like every 100 feet, there's a water bottle.
Yeah.
And because we didn't know what we were doing. But yeah, so we trained really, really hard. And my only goal was to run it without stopping. And I forgot about this hill at the end. But, you know, we started out together and we just made a deal that we were going to do our own thing. And And someone actually, someone read the book and they went back and investigated. And I think Heather was about 40 seconds ahead of me. So I got to watch her finish. And we got so emotional at the end of that. People thought we got really bad news.
Yeah. You know, you said you guys were just sobbing like
crazy. It was bad. It was bad.
You know, Tim, you say that a journey worth traveling has no end. Can you tell me what that means to you?
Yeah, I think as I get older, it changes. And as I get further in my journey, not only does it not have an end, but we work on different parts of ourselves. I've had a rough couple. In fact, that book was supposed to end at my half Ironman Lake Placid. That was the culmination of the book. And I hired a book coach and I said, look, my story fell apart after that. Like everything went to crap. And I had done like most of the things that I had to undig through were because I made bad choices, right? And then all of a sudden I'm doing everything right and everything starts falling apart. You know, I lose function on my legs. You know, I had a failed ankle surgery. I had a tumor. I had an ulnar nerve surgery. I had a muscle reattachment. Then they tell me that they got to amputate my foot or fuse it, but they didn't know if the fusion. So, I mean, these past couple of years have taught me a lot. So the point I'm trying to make is our journey isn't just one linear path. It's got multiple facets to it, and it shouldn't have a destination. You know, I look behind me at all these medals and, you know, the 8-minute miles and stuff, and I'm never going to get back to there. I'll still log miles because I enjoy doing it. But, you know, the biggest thing with your journey is not to compare yourself to other people, which a lot of people know that. But what I'm learning now is not to compare myself to where I think I should be or where I was 5 years ago. And I think the idea to this is, you know, keep the blinders on in your journey and you just keep moving forward. And the biggest takeaway is to do the best you can with the tools you have available now.
Mm-hmm. Tim, I want to talk for a sec about, so you said that the last couple of years have been rough between the ankle, should they amputate, should we do the fusion? You also woke up that one morning and your legs, you found out that you had spinal stenosis and you had surgery for that. And you said the only way that you were going to do this surgery if there was no opiates. Yeah. So can you tell everybody the conversation that you had with the doctors around the opiates?
Yeah, that was a tough one. I was in a really bad place with that because I literally lost. They thought I might have ALS because I lost function on my legs. It was awful. So what they had to do is they had to remove 4 of the 5 lamina from my lumbar spine. They made a deal not to put a cage in or not to fuse my back because I wanted to ride my tri bike and I didn't know how I'd do it. So he said I had a really strong core. So the surgery was brutal. 32 staples, over a foot long cut up my spine. They had to move a lot of muscle, a lot of stuff. It was going to be very painful, brutal, brutal surgery. And I didn't know how to tell the doctor this, but I made myself a promise that I would never take opioids again. So we're wheeling back there. There's a team of about 12 doctors by this point. And right before they're, you ready to go, Mr. Kaufman? I'm like, yeah, there's just one thing. I do not want any opioids before, during, or after. And everyone stopped. And the anesthesiologist said, well, why is that? And I said, well, I had a really bad addiction to opioids and I don't ever want to take them again. And he kind of got down low and he says, you know, you're not going to relapse. You won't even know you have them. I'm like, that's not the point. He goes, well, what's the point? And I said, I made 2 promises with myself. 1, I would never put that poison in my blood again. And 2, I would never break that promise. Mm. And they were all crying. They made me cry. And they left for about 5 or 10 minutes and they all came back and they said, okay, change of plans. And so I did that surgery And what made this one a little more special is they can't do local. Like for my legs, they can do nerve blocks, mm-hmm. and they can really juice them up. With the spine, you can't do that because I had to walk out of the hospital. But you know what, Rip? I was waiting for the pain train. I've had about 5 surgeries with no opioids. I was waiting for the pain train, and it never came. I just relax, stay grateful, listen to music, write a little bit. And I did just fine.
Yeah. Yeah. You say in the very beginning and the very end of this, of your book, this is a book about perspective, period. Perspective almost killed me, but it also shattered my chains and gave me a new life. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the beautiful thing about perspective, this for anyone, whatever you're struggling with, whatever your challenges are, the cool thing about perspective is you get to choose it. Like it's totally in your court. Like you have complete control over how you perceive something. We can't always, you know, control our circumstance. We don't, you know, like I say, the first half of that book is, hey, I made really bad decisions. Everyone around me paid for them, as did I. And then I got my crap together, right? But just because you make good decisions doesn't mean life is going to be, you know, a bowl of cherries. And we have to remember that we get to choose how we see the situation. And I always like to use the word but. Like, yep, this sucks, but I got this. Or but at least I don't have this. And I think that takes practice, the perspective, because it's easy to get in a place where we just stew over our problems and just regurgitate them, and life will suck. And I think another thing that society, I'm sorry, they call me Fat Man Rants because I'm trying not to rant, but another thing society has kind of trained us to do is think that life is always supposed to be perfect. We look at Instagram, we see snapshots of these beautiful lives. Why can't ours be like that? Life sucks sometimes. You know, I tell students that life is going to suck, but it's okay. Because one, it's temporary. Two, there's other people going through it. Find people to help you. It's not going to last forever, you know. And I think without having the lows, we can't get the highs. And when we use things like food and drugs to escape, we want to have this like flatlined life. We're missing out on all the good stuff. I wouldn't know how good it is to wake up in the morning and feel great if I didn't experience how badly I felt when I woke up on drugs, alcohol, with no hope. And I think perspective, the most beautiful thing about perspective is we get to decide, you know, how we see things.
Bravo. What's going on July 21st, 2024? Something that we should be staying tuned to?
Yeah. So I'm going to, this honestly, I said it last time, ended the book with this. This is going to be my last time. I got a little bad news in November. I got to get a new knee. I got a torn meniscus on the outside and inside, torn ACL, and there's nothing left in my knee. They wanted to replace it, and I said, let's schedule that for September. Because wow. I got a long summer of training, and you know, I've been training up to in the 80 miles on the bike, 18 miles on the run. We ran Nashville half last week, so I'm doing good. I'm doing good, but I do need a new knee. So this will be my last hurrah. Lake Placid. I can't think of a better year to do it. It's the 25th anniversary. Mike Riley's coming back to announce it. He's coming out of retirement, so it's going to be a party up there. Woo-hoo-hoo. Yeah.
Tim, so many incredible gems that you have shared with people. I highly recommend that everybody go to Amazon. Where's the best place to get this, Tim? What do you recommend?
Yeah, Amazon. You know, we have a few signed copies left on our website. We went through a ton of them. But yeah, Amazon is probably the best place. The audio version is out too, and I've heard it's really good.
Yeah. Are you the one that reads it?
I did. Yeah. I set up a little studio here. It was a pain.
God, good for you. One of my biggest regrets with my books was that I didn't take the time to read them. I was like, oh, I can't take, because they wanted me to fly to New York and take 5 days to read, especially the first one. And I was like, oh, no. I'm so regretful now. So way to go. Way to do that.
Yeah. Thank you. Hey, Rip, I want to say one more thing before we say goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, this lifestyle, you know, the plant-based lifestyle, the overcoming challenges, like there's nothing special about me. I need people to understand I don't have more willpower than someone else. I don't have any magic powers. And, you know, I'm just a normal guy. And this lifestyle, honestly, it's out there for anyone. And that's why I do what I do. I mean, I have a really good life now. I have a great career, but we spend a lot of time, thousands of hours, just telling people that this is out there for anyone. Yeah. There's no magic about this. It's just eating whole food that's exclusively plants and just having a good attitude, right? And just not quitting. And anybody can do this, really. And it doesn't matter if you have 400 pounds to lose or 10 pounds to lose, or you just want to get healthy. It's all the same process. Mm-hmm. Just eat whole plant foods. That's all it is. And have a good attitude.
Hooray! I cannot wait to follow you. July 21st, 2024. No matter what happens, you're there and you're in the arena and you're going for it. And that's what I love.
Yeah. Yeah. Rip, I appreciate it. It's been a great chatting with you.
Hey, give me a Plant Strong virtual fist bump, my man. Bam.
All right.
Hey, I'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Tim's memoir, Escape, Breaking Free from a Self-Made Prison, is out wherever books are sold, and I'll be sure to put a link to purchase it in the show notes for today, along with his social media channels where you can follow his journey to Iron Man and beyond. Thanks so much for listening to the Plan Strong podcast, and remember, there is always hope, and sometimes it just takes one small change to begin to turn it around. As always, keep it Plan Strong forever and ever. The Plan Strong podcast team includes Carrie Barrett, Lori Kordowich, and Amy Mackey. If you like what you hear, do us a favor and share the show with your friends and loved ones. You can always leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, make sure to hit that follow button so that you never miss an episode. As always, this and every episode is dedicated to my parents, Dr. Caldwell B. Esselstyn Jr. and Ann Cryle Esselstyn. Thanks so much for listening. Back in February of this year, we invited you, our wonderful, enthusiastic community, to be part of the Plan Strong Test Kitchen and provide us with feedback around our all-new burger mixes. And I got to tell you, the feedback and support that you guys showed us blew us away, and we have been hard at work in the kitchen, and we now have our first program graduates, 3 delicious skillet burger mixes. We're going to be launching them into the universe so you can stock up ahead of Memorial Day weekend. You can check them out at planstrong.com. The 3 flavors are black bean, portobello mushroom, and our all-new sweet curry. Once mixed with 6 to 7 ounces of water or broth, the dough may be pan-fried, air-fried, or baked to a crispy, aromatic, rich golden brown. These mixes, they take the hard work out of making healthy burgers at home and yield quality results. They're whole grain, oil-free, a great source of protein and fiber, and they're made from a combination of ground oats, beans, seeds, and spices without any of the added sugar or excessive salt. I want to thank all of you for being such an important part of the Plant Strong Test Kitchen, and I know that you're going to love these as much as I do. Thanks so much.